The John Murray Show on RTE Radio 1 with Kia Credit. You can drive a great deal with flexible finance from Kia, home of the 7-year warranty.
Podcast today's show at rte.ie/John Murray.
The John Murray Show on RTE Radio 1.
Our text number is 51551. Our email address, john at rte.ie. Now, by her own admission, my next guest was in a black hole not too long ago. To her credit, she has come out of it and has become, I suppose, what you'd call a poster girl for budget cooking and shopping. Jack Munro, good morning.
Good morning.
And you're very much the face of frugal cuisine at the moment. Your interest, though, was initially triggered by necessity. You were a new mother and you lost your job.
Yes, I was trying to feed myself and my son on unemployment benefits, which for quite a lot of time didn't actually come through in full or on time. So I had to find ways to feed myself and my son on very little money. So it wasn't a thing I woke up one day and thought, oh, this looks like a fun challenge, I'm going to do this. It was born very much out of necessity.
And Jack, tell us about losing your job after becoming a mother.
Well, I left my job, but it's a sort of left lose situation because after I went back to work after maternity leave, I was working night shifts in the fire service in the 999 control room. So I was working from 6 p.m. at night until 9 a.m. the next morning, two nights on the trot. So leaving your child for 15 hours or 16, 17 isn't ideal as a new mother, and neither is trying to find somebody who can care for your young child for those periods of time. So I asked the fire service for flexible working hours and day work roles, or to just do days only while I sorted out some childcare, and they turned me down flat. So after a couple of months of wrangling and meetings and trying to pull out every policy that they had to try and get some flexible hours or some better working hours, I had no choice but to resign, and I did. And people said, you know, you'll be fine, you've been in a uniformed service, people will chew your arm off to employ you because you've been in the fire brigade, and nobody chewed my arm off to employ me.
And you applied for enough.
Life got quite hard.
Yeah, Jack, and you applied for enough jobs.
Yeah, over 300 before I stopped counting, and I only know that 300 figure because they were the ones I applied for by email, and I would put them in an email folder called Jobs Applied For, and it just was hundreds, absolute hundreds. But hostile job market, you know, there's hundreds of people applying for every vacancy out there, and being in the fire service doesn't really equip you for doing things like working in a shop, or you've got no translatable experience for employers. They look at your CV and I think some of them were a bit intimidated, a bit like, what do we do with you? You know, where do you fit in?
So you were left really bereft because you had hoped to get a new job but couldn't, and suddenly you found yourself in a fairly penniless state.
Yes, I did. And it's one of the things that, you know, I was applying for every kind of work out there. I applied to be a traffic warden. I applied to clean cafes. I applied for healthcare assistant roles at my local hospital. Just anything, absolutely anything that would have been daytime work that I could have found childcare for. I wasn't fussy. Mm. But there was nothing out there for quite a long time.
So describe the scene for us then, without a job and your boy to look after, and the necessity of I suppose, feeding him and making sure that he was healthy and well.
Well, it's difficult. You use what you've got, you use what you can afford. You go around the supermarket and you pick up the cheapest things that you can buy that you can assemble to make meals out of. So things like tins of tomatoes and bags of pasta for 39p. And you think, okay, that's pasta and tomatoes. That's a meal, sort of. And you learn to rely on cooking skills that you've got, because I'd been cooking, I'd living by myself for a few years by then, so I'd been cooking anyway. And adapt them to what you can afford. And it's hard with a toddler. You know, they've been used to having different things. They've been used to having things maybe that they like, or things of better quality, or maybe, you know, more desserts than they'll get these days. And suddenly you've got to say, well, actually, no, that pasta with tomatoes on is all you've got, and if you don't eat it, you'll go to bed hungry. And I'm very lucky that my son, he's three now, he's four at the end of the month, he's not a fussy eater. He eats what's put in front of him. He doesn't say, no, I want something else or anything like that in the way that, you know, some children might do. I don't know if that's just his temperament or if it's because actually that's how he's been brought up.
But incidentally, Jack, what about your son's father? Was he there to lend a hand?
My son's father has a family of his own. He's he didn't when we had my son, but he has a new family of his own. He is supportive. He's a good man. He looks after his son on a weekly basis. He sees him overnight. He's a good dad. They've got a great relationship. He wasn't in a position to help out financially, and you know, that's that. You know, when I finally admitted to my friends and family, and my son's father included, how bad things were, a lot of people stepped up and helped and said, for God's sake, why didn't you just say something? I think that's something that people who haven't been in that situation struggle to comprehend, is why you don't ask for help or why you are so ashamed of your situation.
Yeah, why didn't you? Given, I presume, your parents would have lent a helping hand, and presumably, as you say, you have good friends as well.
As I said, you become quite withdrawn, quite in denial about your situation. When you've gone from having a good job with a good income and a nice home, and being in your group of friends, and you can go out and you can do things together, and you suddenly, you lose all that. You leave all that behind, and you become sitting in your house with your back to the front door with bailiffs banging on it, or you've got debt letters piling up, and you just stop telling people how bad things are. Because the biggest fear for me was losing my son. I know it probably wasn't a reality. My parents are foster carers, and I've seen firsthand over the past 20 odd years the reasons why children get taken into care, or the reasons why parents lose their children or lose contact with their children. I had this really innate fear that if I admitted to anyone that we were cold and we were hungry and that life was going seriously wrong and that I wasn't coping, that I might lose my son. So I just kept very, very quiet and prayed that it would all sort itself out in the end, until it got to a point where it wasn't sorting itself out and I finally turned to my friends and family for help. But I left the fire service in November 2011. And I admitted to my friends how bad things were in the summer that followed that. So it was a good 6, 7, 8 months of just getting my head down and coping and pretending everything was okay.
And how much were you surviving on? How much money?
Well, after everything, I had about £10 a week on average left that I would do my food shop with. I was quite organised about it. I would, when my child benefit came in, I would go and put £10 on a gift card at the supermarket, so that no matter what bills came out of my account or bank charges, that I had that physical £10 that I couldn't spend on anything else.
And tell us then, with that £10 in your pocket to spend on necessities, give us an idea of your average shopping.
I'd get a packet of pasta for 39p, a kilo of rice for 40p, tinned tomatoes for 31p, kidney beans for 27p for a can, tinned mackerel for 55p. You'd learn to use sort of frozen green vegetables, so I'd get a bag of those a week, so £1.49 for a kilo of spinach or peas or cabbage or other green veg. And you just alternate your carbs and your proteins and your green veg until you've got a bit of a system going where things overlap, and you've always got half a bag of rice in the cupboard, or half a bag of pasta, or a couple of tins of tomatoes. And after a while, you just become quite adept at it.
And you had to queue at a food bank for the first time.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about £10 for food is that it doesn't go very far, certainly doesn't go far enough. And I was eventually referred to a food bank for help.
And what was that like?
Well, the first time you go, it's a really odd experience. It's humiliating, it's embarrassing. My local food bank is overlooked by four tower blocks of flats and lots of offices. And you queue up outside around the block, and everybody who can see you knows why you're there. So I just sort of put my head down, and again, in complete denial, just put my head down and pretended I wasn't there, and just shuffled through a queue for about half an hour until you get to the food bank. And the volunteers, they were lovely and they were really kind and they were non-judgmental and they offered so much more than food.
And what would have been in the typical food parcel you got?
It would be things like pasta, rice, chopped tomatoes, soup, and then you got unlimited fruit and vegetables. But if you weren't one of the first 30 people in the queue, the fruit and vegetables went. So you had to get there early to get fruit and veg. And it was stuff that had been rejected from Ocado deliveries and Sainsbury's deliveries and Tesco's deliveries locally, that instead of returning them to the central depot, they would then be delivered to the food bank instead. So it's all perfectly good stuff. A bit of a mishmash sometimes, depending on what people had ordered with their shopping. But generally, you could get some good staple products.
Yeah, and you say, Jack, at the time that you became withdrawn because of your circumstances, but around about the same time, you got very exercised and angry and I suppose politicised.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I started writing my blog initially as a political blog from a single mother's point of view, after a local councillor was on the front page of the newspaper saying that druggies, drunks and single mums were ruining the town back in February 2012. And I was furious at that because I was a single mum myself living in the town centre. And I was like, who are these people that run my town, that make these decisions, that think that I'm such a scumbag? So I started to go along to the local council meetings and started to write about them from a single mum's perspective. And my blog grew from that into day-to-day job searching as a single parent, Other issues with benefits and things like that that cropped up during the months that followed, and eventually evolved into the blog that it is now, which is basically a food and political commentary blog.
And it has a huge following. When did you realise that you were striking a chord with so many people?
I'm not sure when the penny dropped, to be honest. I had a phone call in January, not just gone, the one before, from the Telegraph asking if they could come round for lunch. And I remember at the time thinking that that was really quite odd, where they'd heard of me or how they'd picked me up. But they did. They came round for lunch and I cooked one of my budget recipes, and they wrote a really nice feature called My 49p Lunch with a Girl Called Jack. And it was after that then I was offered the book deal by Penguin Books for 100 recipes based on the recipes that have been on my blog. And even then it didn't really sink in. I just thought, oh, this will be a laugh. You know, it's a job at the end of the day. I need a job. And here's Penguin offering me some money to do some work, which by my reckoning is a job. So I said yes and I bashed it out, and here it is. And I think it's only been lately, really, the past couple of months, that I've started to trust it. I think I've got an income coming in. It's not as much as people think it is, but I can live on it. I've got an income coming in. I've got a job. I get up every day and I work, and I've got money in my bank account, and I finally feel like life might be okay again.
But you've also been offered, or at least you got an offer of big money from one supermarket chain, Tesco.
Yes, I did. And I turned it down because I didn't feel that that would have been an honest thing to do. It's not where I shop, only by virtue of geography. When I was living in my old flat in Southend, I lived opposite Sainsbury's, so it's where I shopped because I could walk to it. And I'd always been quite honest about that on my blog. So not to promote Sainsbury's, but just to say to people, this is where I shop. And to be accountable, to say to people, this is where I shop, this is how much it costs. If you look in your supermarket, you can find similar items for a similar price.
So you've no arrangement with Sainsbury's then, other than being a shopper there?
I had no arrangement with Sainsbury's. I've appeared in a six-week advert campaign for them with three other food writers and bloggers recently, and that's come off the back of that was the advert that they wanted to do, and I was like, oh, okay, I shop with you, I liked the advert, I liked the ad campaign that we're running, it seemed to fit with what I was doing, and I said yes, but aside from that, no.
Right, okay. And Jack, another interesting thing is that you decided, because your blog is called A Girl Called Jack, obviously the name change came before that. You used to be Melissa.
Yeah, it was, you know, Jack's always been a nickname, and it was always something that a lot of people called me, and I feel I'm quite tomboyish and, you know, a little bit butch, and it just suits me a hell of a lot better.
Okay, and what about Melissa? What was wrong with Melissa?
It just didn't suit me at all, and I think anyone that meets me would completely agree with that. I've got, funnily enough, friends called Melissa, and they suit their name perfectly. They're very pretty girls, nice long curly hair, and I'm just not one of those girls. I am a Jack.
Yes, indeed, and one of the things you did was come out during this period.
Yeah, I did. I decided that it was time. I share a lot with my readers. They've had a lot from me, the ins and outs, some real upsetting emotional periods of my life, some of my happy times as well, when I moved house and I found my flat and I completely fell in love with it. And then other things like Hunger Hurts, where I write about the struggles of trying to feed yourself and your family on next to no money. And I felt like I shared so much with my readers, but a few of them gently inquired about my love life or about my romantic things, and I was always a bit coy about it. And then I started to write a piece for the Huffington Post about Pride on London Pride Day last year. And as I started to write this piece about Pride and prejudice against gay people, I started to come out as I was writing it, and I felt myself doing it, and I just thought, actually, this is exactly the right time. If I lose readers, fans, followers, friends over publicly admitting that I'm a lesbian, then they're not readers, fans, followers or friends that I want. And actually the outpouring of support that I got from people was fantastic, and I got a little bit of abuse, and I expected that, and I don't think that's right, and I don't condone it, but I expected it. But I got a lot of love and a lot of support from people, and I stand by that it was one of the best decisions that I've made.
And did you lose any friends in coming out, and how did your parents react to it?
My parents are fine. My parents have known I was gay for years and years. So I think I first mooted the idea with them when I was about 14. So they've had quite a while to get used to it.
We're talking now about all you've been through over the last few years, and the book, as you say, that has come out of it And presumably through all of this, you've managed to establish very strong cooking skills.
It's something that I learned along the way, really. I did food technology, home economics at school. It wasn't my best subject. I only got a D grade in it for GCSE, so my food tech teachers are quite amused at where I've ended up, because it wasn't my strongest subject. But I remember enjoying it and enjoying the creativity. And I always have to remind people that I'm not a chef. I'm just a home cook. I'm just a mum that cooks. But I try to keep my food simple and unintimidating. And, you know, whenever I do any videos or any filmings of me cooking, I know that I'm overly apologetic, that I don't chop things up like a chef, and that I'm not fancy, and that I don't really know the right terminology. But I think that that's okay, because there's a place in the world for chefs and celebrity chefs and people that run restaurants and things like that, and that's all well and good. But most of us just want to be able to knock up some food at home, so we don't all run 100 cover restaurants.
No, we don't, indeed. And I'm just wondering, though, with the fact that now you've a bit more money in your pocket, are you tempted to start buying things that are a bit more expensive, or do you feel a sort of a duty to be going down the frugal road?
Well, I have no inclination to blow it all on caviar and foie gras, but my weekly food shop is now more than £10 a week. I have a partner, between us we have two children, so 10 is not going to stretch, and I have got an income now, but I stick to the same principles. I buy things cheaply or in like cheap forms, like frozen green vegetables still. I still use a lot of canned pulses in my cooking, but I can make some changes now that I was never really comfortable with back in the darkest days. I can buy free-range eggs now instead of barn eggs, which really aren't that much more expensive, but were completely out of my budget when my budget was £10 a week. I've chosen that I'll only buy free-range meat now instead of battery farmed chicken or any other type of meat that isn't free-range or freely farmed. And I think that, you know, if you can afford to make those changes and you can afford to make those decisions, then do so. But if you can't, then your priority is feeding yourself and your family. It's, you know, I know that in my situation, a year or so ago, if anyone had turned around to me and said, you shouldn't be buying barn eggs, I'd have told them to stick it.
And tell me, what's this about Hollywood interest in your life and times?
Oh yeah, apparently so. The Wolf of Wall Street producer got in touch with my agent to ask for my life rights, to which I turned them down flat because I'm not an island and they're not my life rights. I've got a partner, my son has a father, I've got a mother and father, I've got grandparents, I've got friends and family, and their life rights are not mine to sell. You can't tell my story without involving other people in it, and it's not my place to go giving Hollywood directors permission to go raking through other people's lives. I'm very protective over my friends and family. I've been catapulted into this hotbed of debate. I know that I'm quite a divisive figure. You've only got to look at any of my articles on The Guardian to see that there's no real middle ground. There's people who either really get what I'm doing and really support it, or people who, for whatever reason, the fact that I'm a woman or that I'm gay or I'm a bit outspoken or just generally don't like me. And I'm a big girl, I can take that on the chin.
Yeah, I'm just wondering about...
But I don't want to catapult anyone else into that.
But on the subject of criticism and being able to take it, I'm just looking here at one particular column by Richard Littlejohn in the Daily Mail, and he branded you beyond parody after you blogged a recipe for kale pesto pasta for 42 pence. And then Edwina Curry, the former Conservative MP, had a go at you on the subject of benefits. So do you tend to fight back, or do you just ignore it?
I can take criticism. I take criticism on the chin. I think if I spent my days responding to people who disagreed with me, then I'd do little else. But people who tell outright lies or try to really outright smear what I'm trying to do, like Richard Littlejohn, like Edwina Curry, I do take the time and the trouble to respond to that, because I think, no, you can't just go around printing lies about me. The good thing about the internet and about social media is that we've all got an equal platform now. So Richard Littlejohn can write some stuff about me and I can respond to it 10 minutes later, which is what I did. Just putting him right and correcting the facts. And to me, I think that that's quite important. I think it's important that people don't allow people like that to bully them or manipulate them. I think that by standing up to bullies and standing up to people who try to put you back in your box or put you in your place or lie about you or undermine what you're trying to do is quite an important message to send out, because, you know, he might live in his gated Florida mansion and earn £800,000 a year writing for the Daily Mail, but that doesn't give him the right to rewrite my life to fit his agenda. So I very firmly was just like, no, I'm not standing for that. But I mean, with this level of profile comes a lot of criticism and a lot of, you know, people are so accessible these days. I'm on Twitter, so if somebody wants to be horrible to me, they just have to look me up on Twitter and there you go, they can send it away. And having that all times of the day and night is quite difficult to deal with sometimes. But generally, people are nice and lovely and supportive and respectful. And it's really great to make those connections and meet people and hear from people.
And would it not tempt you to go off Twitter?
No. I like Twitter too much. I mean, great things have happened through Twitter. I've had messages from people of support, people who I've idolised, you know, people who have
like
been
who?
Inspirations to me. I had a message from Nigella Lawson last week.
Great.
And to me, I just was like, wow, what's happened to my life? You know, I've got so many of her cookbooks. She's a huge inspiration, both as a cook and as a woman and as a person in the public eye. And I really admire and respect her hugely. Somebody else, Nigel Slate, has been in touch a few times to say that he likes what I do. And to me, it's astounding. But also the ordinary people that get in touch every day to say, look, I made some bread using one of your recipes, or here's one of my children cooking in the kitchen helping me because your recipes are really easy. Mm. Getting that day-to-day validation that you're doing something good and you're putting something good out into the world and other people are enjoying exploring and experimenting with food and changing the way that they cook and shop. More people get in touch with me on Twitter than on anything else. So I'll take the trolls and the death threats and the abuse because I've got a block button for that.
It's a force for good for the most part.
Yeah, it is.
Well, listen, it's been great chatting to you. The book is called A Girl Called Jack, 100 Delicious Budget Recipes, published by Penguin. And Jack in this case is Jack Munro, and she is the author. Good luck with it. And
thank you.
Good luck with promoting frugal living.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your time.
Podcast today's show at rte.ie/John Murray.
The John Murray Show on RTE Radio 1.